This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, everybody. Happy Friday and welcome to the Men's Hour, brought to you by Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Well, I've been looking around for some stories that you might like. I'm going to start things off with a story from the July 16th edition of Travel and Leisure. That's actually July 16th is my birthday. I turned 67 today. I'm actually reading this to you on my birthday. And this is from Travel and Leisure. It's a story about Australia. Length of the Land, one of the world's largest transcontinental rail journeys, transforms a coast-to-coast ride into an intimate encounter with Australia's vast interior. Australia is one of those places I've always wanted to go. My wife wouldn't do it, and I might need, I don't even know if I would do it. I mean, it's a long, I mean, it's a full day. It's a full 20-plus hour flight to get there. And if you're going to go to Australia, you're going to have to go for a few weeks. We're retired, so we could do whatever we want, right? I would love to go to go there just to see it and to experience it. But anyway, here's a way to experience it, at least through the eyes of this writer. In the glare of the intense sun, the Indian Pacific had a reflective chromatic glow. The nearly 3,000-foot-long train, that's over half a mile, was patiently idling beside the platform at East Perth Terminal, where a spread of scones, strawberry jam, clotted cream, and Bollinger champagne welcomed eager travelers. Over the hubbub of excitement, I could hear an acoustic guitar being played a few feet from where we stood. This jubilant scene had been orchestrated by Journey Beyond, an Australia-based train and tour operator that was about to take me and nearly 200 other guests on a five-day odyssey along one of the world's longest transcontinental railway routes. Soon we'd jump aboard and wave goodbye to Perth, the capital of Western Australia, and start hurtling eastward towards Sydney, some 2,700 miles away. Just for some context, that'd be the equivalent of maybe New York City to Los Angeles, you know. Along the route, we'd be chugging between outback towns and weaving through mind-expanding deserts and mountain ranges. The story of the continent's train service begins at the turn of the 20th century. A newly unified Australia, which had been a collection of separate British colonies until 1901, was faced with one of its first major challenges: connecting its various railroads so they could span the full breadth of the land. While the country was successful in creating the Trans-Australian Line in 1917, differing rail gauges left gaps in service that forced passengers to switch trains several times to reach their destinations. Finally, in 1968, a fully continuous line was completed, driven by the need to transport iron ore to the coast. Just 2 years later, the Indian Pacific embarked on its maiden voyage from Sydney, sharing the tracks with industrial rail freighters. It arrived in Perth 3 days later at the same station I was now departing from, to the frenzied welcome of 10,000 spectators. Since then, the accommodations and experiences of the Indian Pacific have evolved, but its old-world sense of adventure, thanks to direct access to the Golden Outback, the western region of the country's vast interior, with ties to the gold rush of the late 1800s, has remained. I'd already seen much of Australia's coastline through a series of drives, but I'd long wanted to explore the country's heartland. The Indian Pacific, newly relevant thanks to an updated itinerary, was my chance. After settling into my relatively spacious cabin, which had a couch that converted into a queen-size bed, I went to join my fellow passengers for a nightcap. There are three carriage classes on the Indian Pacific: Gold, Gold Premium, and Platinum. While Gold and Gold Premium share a dedicated lounge and dining car, Platinum has its own. This April, the train operator further bolstered its lineup with two larger luxury suites, Aurora and Australis, which both come with dedicated butler service. I can't imagine how much that costs. I arrived at the Platinum Lounge to find guests already mingling over even more glasses of Bollinger. I detected accents from the United Kingdom, Switzerland, and Canada. Many travelers were making their way to the opposite coast for weddings, family reunions, or farther voyages to Tasmania or New Zealand. Rather than fly over the country and miss the landscapes unfolding on the ground, they'd chosen to catch a train and see what few others do. The next morning found us in Calgary, an outback city established during the gold rush. Miners flooded the dusty flats surrounding this area after three Irish prospectors who had immigrated to Australia in the hopes of making their fortunes accidentally stumbled across gold while looking for water in 1893. "We've been digging gold out of the ground at a furious rate ever since," Steve Mogridge, a former miner turned guide, told our group of passengers on an excursion focused on the quirky history and present-day lore of the city. While he drove us around its Edwardian-era streets, he shared that in its heyday, Calgary had 115 drinking establishments serving 25,000 thirsty miners, including one notable American engineer named Herbert Hoover, decades before he became the 31st president of the United States. "We stopped at a historic town hall and the Super Pit, an immense open-cut gold mine, the largest in Australia. It made the 176-ton yellow trucks inside look like children's toys. We then ended the day at Chunky Timber Company, an art business that turns reclaimed wood into furniture, homewares, and jewelry. A massive dinosaur sculpture, the work of artisan Heath Parsons, and owner Kim Chunky Gent, a bear of a man sporting an impressive white beard, greeted us at the entrance. We made the dinosaur for Breast Cancer Awareness Month," Jet told us. "She got sent around town and came back with a pink bra hanging out of her mouth." That's awesome. On a tour of his workshop, he explained how locals regularly deliver scrap materials to his door to be reworked into something new. "Nothing goes to waste. Even wood chips are sanded to create necklace beads, and he never corrects errors that appear during the process. The world needs more mistakes," Gent told me. Once we were back on board, the train dashed deeper into the desert, crossing the South Australian border. Motley collections of water towers, sandstone buildings, and weatherboard houses amid a sea of sun-bleached grass slid past my window as I sat down for dinner. The daily rotating menu draws from various stops along the route. That night, I was served a zesty octopus caught in Perth and paired with chimichurri and saltbush, an herb native to arid interior plains like the ones surrounding Kalgoorlie. "When do we see the desert?" asked one traveler while we were finishing our meal. As if in response, the Nullarbor plain appeared through the windows, a flat and semi-arid 77,000 square mile expanse. That's amazing. This vast landscape confounded its first European explorers, who battled dehydration and disorientation in the days of Australian colonization. Though the Yinyilla Nation lived in this region for at least 30,000 years. We were all surprised at how full of life it was, populated with hardy scrub, birds, and reptiles, even in the middle of a parched summer. Around midnight, the train came to a stop at Cook, a lonely outpost stuck almost midway between Perth and Adelaide, originally built to support the railway. The staff invited us to step off the train and sip champagne or hot chocolate around a blazing bonfire. Enveloped by the warm glow, I looked up to find the Milky Way stretched across an enormous black canvas. I imagine that the sights of the sky are very visible from most areas of Australia. The next morning, I woke up to the aroma of coffee floating down the carriage hall and a Dali-esque landscape outside my window. Overnight, we had crossed the dried, cracked remnants of salt lakes. The blue outline of the Flinders Ranges, the largest mountains in South Australia, now rose from the horizon like a sleeping colossus. As I ate my crispy frittata, sprightly wallabies and emus darted in and out of the bushes, seemingly attempting to race the string of rail cars. I welcomed the start of day three as a much more languid affair, with little more to do than read a book or help solve the communal 2,000-piece puzzle laid out on one of the dining tables. Intrigued by the extensive Australian wine list on board, one guest requested an impromptu tasting to fill the time. As we sipped our way through Chardonnays, Pinot Noirs, and Cabernets, with a detour into a unique blend of Greenwich, Syrah, and Murfreesboro grapes, bottled together as GSM, a guitarist, one of the Indian Pacific's musicians, ambled into the carriage and started to play. The tasting continued once we reached Adelaide in the late afternoon. Our destination was Sepples Field Estate, established in 1851 in the now award-winning Barossa Valley by German couple Joseph and Johanna Seppelt, S-E-P-P-E-L-T. The vineyard is home to one of the Australia's most successful wine dynasties. The Seppelts had over 100 staff who lived on site, and the chef had to feed them every day, said current chef Owen Andrews, who works part-time at the estate. Their whole concept of food came from Europe, and they tried to adapt what they knew to the Australian summer. Today, he continued, the vineyard's history is core to how he curates the modern menu for guests. For instance, Andrews has adopted the historic technique of preserving cheese wheels in a tawny port to enhance the flavor. He's also reopened the winery's antique smokehouse to make bacon and smoke-infused butter. In the estate's centennial cellar were dozens of neat rows of wooden barrels labeled with dates all the way back to 1878. Seppeltsfield is home to one of the world's longest unbroken lines of single vintage tawnies. I was handed a dainty glass of tawny produced in 1925, the same year F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby was published, a 100-year-old tawny. The thick, nearly black liquid coated my tongue, delivering a knockout combination of warm spices and dried citrus. I barely had time to recover before being whisked over to a dining hall that resembled a wedding venue. Towers of roasted meats and salad piled high on white linen-covered tables, a live band playing as we took our seats. Between courses, a master cooper treated us to a fire-barreling demonstration, unleashing tall jets of flame that shot to the ceiling and filled the air with the aroma of charred oak. Following this grand send-off from the winery, the Indian Pacific traveled northeast overnight across the New South Wales border to Broken Hill, a sister mining town to Kalgoorlie. I met Chef Lee Session at her restaurant, the Old Saltbush, which is housed inside a 137-year-old former pub. Here, the focus is squarely on foods found in the bush. Drawing my attention to a plate of a dozen different native ingredients, Session explained how they are used in creative ways. Nutty wattle seed can be ground up and added to cakes. Spicy pepperberry tastes delicious on gamey kangaroo steaks. Cucumber-shaped finger limes, known as the caviar of citrus, for their delicate pearls, make a lip-smacking mojito. Next, Session presented a delicate cloud of pavlova, the national dessert of Australia and New Zealand, and told me to decorate it. People can be intimidated by native flavors, but the key is to have fun with it, she said, as I piled my meringue with wattle seed, butterscotch, Davidson's plum coulis, and fresh berries. The sugar rush was still coursing through my veins when I arrived back at the Indian Pacific. The crash that followed came right on time, sending me to sleep to the sways of the carriage as we continued eastward through the night. On our final day, I saw a landscape of verdant valleys studded with grazing cattle and curious kangaroos. Before our arrival in Sydney, there would be one final stop in Blue Mountains National Park, just 90 minutes west of the city by car. When we got there, the scene was primordial. The rough-hewn sandstone escarpments were bathed in a blue haze, the result of a reaction between oils released by the eucalyptus trees that cover the valley and water vapor in the air. These ranges have gone by many European names through the years, Blue Mountains, Carmarthen Hills, Lansdowne Hills, but the original one, the one our Kundungurra guide David King uses, is Kolomata, and it's pronounced Gulamata. The area was declared a national park in 1959, the year I was born, a decision King credits with helping to preserve his people's culture and lore. When I was growing up, the role of parents was to nurture while the uncles and aunties teach, he said, as he led our small group deeper into the trees. And a lot of the things I'm sharing with you, I was taught by my Uncle Harold. He proceeded to point out various plants used to repair weapons, ward off mosquitoes, or treat ailments. After demonstrating a song on his clapsticks, a traditional Aboriginal percussive instrument, King showed me how to crack a eucalyptus leaf in my hands. This, along with the burning of the leaf, is a sacred healing practice for the Gulamata people. When I did it, an invigorating woodsy aroma was released, sending a happy chill down my spine. Our time here with King was far too brief. Soon he was leading our group out of the forest to the buses waiting to whisk us back to the train. As I bid him farewell, I noted sadly that my journey would officially end in just a few hours in Sydney. But King didn't see it that way. In Indigenous culture, we never say goodbye. We've only just started a shared journey together. And that's an amazing story, and what would be a once-in-a-lifetime trip, 2,700 miles across the southern part of Australia in the outback. And here's the surprising thing. 3 to 4 night journeys on the Indian Pacific range from $2,286 per person, all inclusive. That's less than I thought it would be. I mean, obviously you'd have to pay a ton to fly to Australia, and you're going to be there for more than the 3 or 4 days on the rail. So that's going to add to it. But what a trip of a lifetime that it would be to take a train ride across the outback of Australia. And obviously, you know, it's not, you're just not on the train the whole time. They're stopping and you're doing excursions and seeing things like he talked about. That would be something I would love, love, love to do. So anyway, hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Next up, we have some stories from the Men's Journal dated July the 9th. And our first one is about a veteran actor that you know when you see his face, but you might not know his name, and that's Kyle Chandler. At 60, Kyle Chandler is entering the superhero game, riding motorcycles with strangers, and learning that the secret to staying sane might just be saying yes. Most 60-year-old Hollywood actors don't agree to spend 2.5 weeks sleeping outside on a dual sports bike sojourn with strangers, especially not on a whim. But Kyle Chandler has a habit of turning ordinary afternoons into adventures. Recently, he was stationed at a grease monkey near home in Dripping Springs, Texas, one of those quick lube chains where if you see a celebrity, it's probably on the waiting room TV. His daughter was giving her old car to a friend, but it needed an oil change. The routine errand turned serendipitous when a man walked in with a Great Dane. Chandler, whose family used to raise the breed, struck up a conversation. The man and his son were about to ride from Canada down the Continental Divide, an epic coming-of-age expedition. Chandler, by his own account, started drooling at the prospect of such a venture. When the man asked if he wanted to come, Chandler didn't hesitate. "Hell yes, I want to go," Chandler said. It's possible the stranger recognized him. Chandler is still Coach Taylor to most of America. People still call him Coach in public. Sometimes they ask him for advice. Friday Night Lights aired from 2006 to 2011, but still appears on streaming services. Chandler remains fixed as a certain kind of TV grown-up. He spent the years since playing roles that prove his range, Bloodline, Catch-22, Super Pumped, but the public shorthand has never really gone away. The fact Chandler is starring in a TV role again comes as no surprise. That he's doing it as the lead of a DC superhero franchise at age 60 is another matter entirely. It's not really the tunnel you expect Coach Taylor to take. But then again, Chandler is keen to accept invitations when they sound like they could be a gas. This summer, he steps into the role of Hal Jordan, one of DC's Green Lanterns. The Green Lantern Corps is an intergalactic police force whose members wield exceptionally powerful rings. Lanterns runs the comic book material through the lens of a gritty prestige crime thriller, pairing Chandler with Aaron Pierre's John Stewart in an 8-episode murder mystery set in rural Nebraska. The rings are controlled by willpower. There are force fields and fights, but the important part is that Chandler plays the old guard and Pierre plays the young buck. The gig may not belong to the older man forever, so yeah, it's a superhero show with the subtext. When is it time to give up the keys? Chandler wasn't waiting for a superhero costume fitting. The man clears brush for fun and rides dual sports bikes with strangers. When the role bubbled up, he was weary and also unaware of its mythology. I thought, I don't know if I'm young enough or buff enough to fit into one of those suits. Once he realized he wouldn't be flying around in tights, he reconsidered. The first time Chandler read Lanterns aloud, it wasn't at Warner Brothers. It was in his living room with his wife Carolyn and daughter Sydney on the couch. He'd finished the script but didn't tell them what he thought. "I didn't want to sway them," he says. He trusted Catherine's ability to judge a script. He played Hal. They played different parts. When they were done, Catherine and Sydney said, "You've got to fucking do this." In Dripping Springs, the notes are shorter than the ones in Hollywood. Part of what made the lantern's role hit Chandler so hard was that he hadn't been feeling especially loose. The years around the pandemic, he says, kind of shook me up. He worked, but wasn't having much fun. He said he was timid, ruminating too much, and at one point in the conversation, references a dark cloud. I ask him to clarify. I wouldn't say depression, Chandler reflects. I wouldn't say anxiety. I wouldn't say I was agoraphobic. I'd say it was a little bit of all that that caused this really strange haze in the air. By the time lanterns came along, he thought, I'm not going to let that stuff bother me. I'm going to shake the rest of it off right now. He'd blow a superhero-sized hole in the clouds, and when he got to Los Angeles, serendipity struck again. His very first trip west, Chandler says, was January 15, 1989, after he and his buddy, Trent, dropped out of the University of Georgia Drama Department. Chandler sat in the back of an Eastern Airlines flight smoking cigarettes all the way to L.A. Yes, but people used to smoke on planes. The trip out for Lanterns was also on January 15th, but no smoking allowed on the plane this time. Then he found out the production was assigned to Warner Brothers Stage 19, where he'd shot Homefront, his first big TV lead. The old man upstairs said, hey, I'm going to give you a gift, Chandler says. He threw me a bone, and I chewed that thing all the way through. At the first table read, he went big. I decided before I went out that I'm going to have fun. Damn the torpedoes. Afterwards, he found Chris Mundy, the showrunner, and asked, can I get away with all that? Mundy replied, that's great. Chandler left sky high. You can see the tone immediately in the pilot. Hal is sitting in a dive bar in a barn jacket, looking slightly beat up and completely pleased with himself. He uses the ring to manifest a $20 bill, feeds the jukebox, and puts a grating early 70s bubblegum hit on repeat to rile up the bar. While the song keeps playing, he tells John how he got the ring. A green bubble yanked him out of bed, dragged him across the sky, and a dying alien's voice ran through his body. Bones, teeth, heart, the whole deal, before handing him the job. Chandler plays the whole thing absolutely straight. Then the bar patrons start kicking the shit out of him. Lanterns needs that looseness because under the rings, it's a two-hander, old guard and rookie, Chandler and Pierre. The two met during the chemistry test where Pierre had this mechanical crank machine on his arm from a boxing injury. Pierre is disciplined and quiet. Chandler introduced himself as the opposite. I'm kind of a loudmouth who talks a lot, he told him. I might have ADD. He doesn't actually describe himself that way, but he wanted Pierre to know what was coming. When he told me that he's quiet and reserved, Chandler says, I was sort of thinking, well, we got to tear that apart. So he set out to annoy him. That's partly why Mundy thought Chandler could carry Hal. The role needed a Chuck Yeager type, but also someone funny enough to make the character's hazing of John feel like banter instead of abuse. He was so much more craft than you realize, Mundy says. He's not just playing himself. The big stuff matters, but Mundy points to the small beats. Hal handing the ring to John and clocking that the younger man may be better at the job. A speech about the loneliness of the work that plays funny, angry, and vulnerable all at once. Chandler didn't arrive as a comic book scholar, but he understood the show should stay grounded. Lore-wise, Lanterns wouldn't be explaining everything that's in the enchilada, Chandler says. He made the mistake of looking online once after the first artwork dropped and found hundreds of people debating the boots, the clothes, all of it. It was really funny, he says, in a kind of scary way, actually. He didn't go back for more. Before television, Mundy wrote some of the greatest Rolling Stone profiles of the 1990s, so I asked him what story he would write about Chandler after watching him on set. His answer came immediately, the move from L.A. to Austin. Chandler, he said, pulled himself out of a specific kind of Hollywood life, even though it might have changed the work available to him. Even if his career hadn't gone as well as it did, Mundy says, my guess was he wouldn't have moved back to L.A. Chandler, Mundy says, chose life over career. Then he got to have both. When I speak with Chandler, he's at home, which usually means he's staring at a list of half-finished home repairs. He and Catherine do most of the heavy lifting themselves, purely because he values his privacy. He says the yard work is also more fun than the gym. Chandler avoids the digital world just as passionately with no social media accounts or digital footprint. That fierce attachment to ordinary life is what makes the changes around Austin sting. Recently, at Joe's Coffee, where he was meeting a director, Chandler saw a blue Ferrari. You gotta be kidding me, he said. A stranger overheard him and reassured him the car was a piece of crap that kept breaking down. Chandler just smiled and said, "Good." All things considered, he's far more accepting of evolution on the home front. His daughter, Sydney, started acting during the pandemic, which changed their relationship almost immediately. At first, she told him she wanted acting classes because she was writing and thought it would help her build characters. Later, she admitted she wanted to act. Once she started auditioning, she asked Chandler to tape scenes with her in the guest house. Soon, they were talking through the emotions and mechanics. There was a dialogue that immediately started between the two of us that we never would have found, he says. Our relationship has never been the same. Catherine's life in Texas grew in its own direction, too. After local veterans needed a dry place to meet, she helped build Patriots Hall, a facility that's grown into a 10-acre campus. Chandler knows many of the vets and their families by name now. Mundy got a glimpse into that tight-knit community, not to mention the actor's heart and integrity when trying to schedule a call. He learned Chandler was busy cooking 200 hamburgers for charity, yet insisted he could still talk if needed. Mundy declined and later remembered thinking, oh, he's the guy. Lately, Chandler's been thinking more about time. He and Catherine keep talking about traveling more, about actually doing things they spent years postponing because of work and kids and life, like a lot of us do. I don't want to end up taking my last breath wherever it comes from, saying, damn it, I didn't do those things. Since Chandler was a kid, he's wanted to cross the Atlantic Ocean in a sailboat. He talks about wanting to hear creaking wood and whales through the hull, maybe feeling the fear of being out in a little wooden boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. As our conversation winds down, Chandler mentions he's got an adventure bike loaded for LA for this very photo shoot. He'll make the same migration he did during Friday Night Lights. It'll give him time to think. I'm still just an actor who's always nervous about not working, then complaining when I get work, he says. A few hours later, Chandler calls back and invites me to swing by Patriots Hall in a few weeks. He'll be flipping burgers again. Whether Chandler the actor or Chandler the man, he's found his place in space and time, somewhere between the cosmic police force and the condiment table. That's a great behind-the-scenes look at one of my favorite actors. And Lantern appears, it will premiere on HBO and HBO Max on August 16th. Now, I got to tell you, I am not someone who goes to the movies or likes to watch these superhero movies. They just don't interest me whatsoever. And everybody's different, right? Everybody has different tastes. And so I'm not going to condemn anybody who does watch those because millions of people go to see them. But it's just not something I like. But if they have them, this one sounds like it might be fun. I mean, kind of like I enjoyed the Guardians of the Galaxy movies just because it's different than what I perceive, at least anyway, of the average Avengers movie or any Marvel movie or any of those. But this one sounds pretty good. So I think I'm gonna give this one a watch on HBO and HBO Max. That's Lanterns, and it will start August 16th. Our next item from Men's Journal, July 9th, is from the Travel Notebook. Parks After Dark. Stick around and skip the crowds. America's national parks deliver their best show after sunset. Just like what we were talking about with Australia, being able to see the night sky without any lights in the way. And honestly, seeing many of the national parks around the country is still on my bucket list. My wife doesn't want to be in the car for long hours, so we're going to have to figure out how to make this work. But anyway, here's a great story about national parks after dark. Many cite the national parks as America's best idea, one so successful it now tests its own limits. When novelist Wallace Stegner wrote The Best Idea We Ever Had in 1983, Great Smoky Mountains National Park drew about 9 million visitors annually. Last year, the Smokies, still the most visited park, saw roughly 11.5 million people, and nearly half of those shoehorned themselves in during July and August. Fortunately, shifting your timing to after dinner is the easiest way to avoid the crowds and experience what most never stick around for. It works even in peak summer. Although many of the 63 national parks provide a break from city lights, only 18 have been certified International Dark Sky Places by Dark Sky International. These parks offer some of the most profound darkness in the country, which naturally thins crowds. Some of them pair the starkness with ranger-led astronomy programs to help frame what you're seeing overhead. With nearly 80% of the population living under light polluted skies, the average person is more likely to see the McDonald's arches than the Milky Way, even though it's visible to the naked eye under the right conditions. From Voyageurs National Park, where the aurora can ripple across the sky, to the exceptionally dark Great Basin National Park, the terrain shifts nearly as much as the stars overhead during prime viewing season, from May through September. This isn't just about escaping crowds, it's about experiencing a familiar idea as something new and still worth preserving. Take a camera with you, and with some basic pointers, you'll leave with print-worthy shots. We didn't invent stargazing, but the United States pioneered something essential, setting aside public lands where the night sky remains accessible to everyone savvy enough to venture out after dark. So we're going to start at Voyageurs National Park in Minnesota. Among national parks built around roads, Voyageurs stands apart for its landscape that prefers a boat to a Bronco. Set at a high latitude, it's also one of the best places in the lower 48 states to see the Northern Lights. Water dominates everything here. Open lake horizons replace tree-lined ridges, and the sky feels less like a dome and more like an infinite scroll in Google Maps. Most people don't associate stargazing with being out at night on a small boat, so crowds are relatively sparse. There are a couple of designated access points that make it straightforward to set up a night of stargazing with a telescope or 7x50 binoculars without a boat. Through the Ash River entrance, the Medwood Road Day Use Area sits on a rocky ridge with an expansive, unobstructed view of the sky, free from the quaking aspen and birch canopy. The northern lot at the Rainy Lake Visitor Center, a short drive from International Falls, Minnesota, sits along the waters of the Dancing Sky Scenic Byway, aptly named for its aurora potential. While the park hosts summer astronomy programs, including the annual Star Party with ranger-led telescope sessions and expert presentations, you can just as easily grab a chair and a snack and let the night sky provide the entertainment. On still nights, the line between sky and lake gets unreliable in a way that feels almost fake, especially in photos. Arrive early and secure a pier or dock facing south-southwest for Milky Way shots, using the structure in the frame to ground the image so it reads as landscape, not just space. Voyageurs offer a front row seat to meteor showers, and the mid-August Perseids are the summer highlight, often delivering up to 100 streaks per hour. If there's crowding, a few trails remain secluded, like Cab Ash, which has views over trees, and Beaver Pond Overlook, which sets you over calm, glassy water. So that's Voyageurs National Park in Minnesota. Glacier National Park in Montana. I've been told I need to go there, and this article just confirms that. Long before the 20-inch aperture of the robotic telescope in the visitor center allowed you to saunter up and see billions of light years away, Glacier National Park was a natural observatory for Native American tribes who used the stars to guide hunts, migration, and harvest. Glacier's dry air, which makes photos and telescopes less hazy, high elevation, and inky darkness create some of the most reliable stargazing conditions in the national park system. Glacier's three visitor centers are the backbone of its stargazing education. On the west side, APGAR hosts ranger-led astronomy nights where you'll learn to identify constellations, planets, and bright deep sky objects using the naked eye and portable telescopes. It's a decidedly analog experience. On the east side, the Dusty Star Observatory anchors a more technologically advanced experience, relying on a large robotic plane wave telescope and imaging systems that project deep sky views for group observation. Between the two is the park's biggest summer jam, the Logan Pass Star Party, which starts at 10 p.m. Think of it as Coachella for astrophotographers. The high altitude summit is held a few times annually along the Going to the Sun Road, where rangers, volunteer astronomers, and amateur sky watchers transform a mountain parking lot into a temporary observatory. Don't wait for the stars. Glacier's glassy lakes offer stunning foregrounds that peak just as blue hour begins to fade. Popular during the day, Swift Current Lake empties at night while still providing views of Grinnell Point. You'll want to put in the work with a short hike to get away from the hotel and lodge lighting. The view of St. Mary Lake from Wild Goose Island Overlook is one of the most iconic scenes, framed by towering mountains and the tiny island itself. It's easily accessible from Logan Pass and St. Mary's Visitor Center. For Milky Way shots, head to Two Medicine Lake. Facing south-southwest, you'll capture the galactic core rising above the Sinopah Mountains and reflective water. And there's some pictures here, and it's just as he says. And you know, there's the Aurora Borealis as well. And you can just see, and there's a picture here showing the Milky Way. It's just crazy beautiful. Here's that was Glacier National Park in Montana. Bryce Canyon National Park in Utah. At roughly 7,800 feet, Bryce Canyon National Park sits high enough to strip away much of the atmosphere that softens night skies, so your eyes, telescopes, and cameras see sharper contrast on clear nights. Utah leads the country in dark sky certified parks because of its geography, remote, arid, and high elevation, and more than a decade of protective policy that keeps much of the state reliable for stargazing. Getting to Bryce Canyon is easy from Las Vegas, Salt Lake City, or southern Utah's hidden gem, St. George, but the timing is more important than the map. On a new moon, the Milky Way takes over, stretching across the sky so dark it feels tangible. Below, the park's famous red limestone hoodoos seem to rise from the amphitheater like stone fingers, pointing your view toward the stars. Incredible. The rangers at Bryce won't leave you to figure things out on your own. The park has offered stargazing initiatives since 1969, making it the longest-running astronomy program in the National Park Service system. Ranger-led sessions are a core part of the experience, blending short, accessible talks with guided telescope viewing that makes even casual viewers feel oriented under the sky. During the summer, telescopes are set up near the visitor center, and rangers work alongside photographers and storytellers to translate what you're seeing into something more meaningful than a checklist of constellations. Each summer, the Astronomy Festival expands things further with multi-day programming that celebrates stargazing and astrophotography. Seasoned photographers or newbies planning to stay a few nights can carve out some private time to shoot by veering away from the amphitheater. Yavimpa Point is the southernmost overlook and one of the best places to frame the Milky Way core, with sweeping views across the Grand Staircase and far fewer people after dark. Fairyland Point is similar to the amphitheater's hoodoo density, but with less foot traffic, while Rainbow Point and Farview Point give you wider, cleaner horizons for sky-dominant compositions. This is about as wide open as views get in Bryce. If the park feels crowded, Kodachrome Basin State Park, about 30 minutes south, is also Dark Sky International certified and trades Bryce's hoodoos for sandpipes, less iconic, but far quieter. And that was Bryce Canyon National Park in Utah. Our last place to see the night sky is Grand Basin National Park in Nevada. There are dark skies, then there's Great Basin National Park near the Nevada-Utah border, 70 miles in every direction from any significant man-made light. Tucked deep in the high desert, far beyond the reach of Vegas's neon, the park is rated a rare Bortle 1 zone, areas with the darkest night skies. Here, the primal darkness makes the Milky Way appear so vivid and textured, it feels almost sculptural. The Snake Range mountains and pine trees, with no light behind them to offer definition, look like paper cutouts. On a clear, moonless night in summer, you'll see the Andromeda Galaxy, a smudge of light 2.5 million light years away, with your naked eye from nearly everywhere in the park. That's incredible. It's the only national park with a research-grade telescope, and while you can't just walk up to the eyepiece, the Great Basin Observatory does offer limited tours at select times of year. That same sky is accessible to everyone through a ranger-led programs at the Astronomy Amphitheater, where guided telescope sessions reveal planets, star clusters, and distant galaxies under ideal conditions. During the annual Astronomy Festival, the park expands into a collaborative space for amateur astronomers, astrophotographers, and educators, with nightly telescope setups, workshops, and occasional appearances by NASA ambassadors. The Star Train ride on the Nevada Northway Railway departs from Ely, Nevada, about an hour west, just before sunset, and pulls up to Star Flat, where rangers take over to give guided telescope sessions. Stella Lake offers one of Great Basin's best foregrounds. Its still waters perfectly mirror the 13,063-foot Wheeler Peak, Reaching this 10,000-foot alpine gem requires a 12-mile-long, switchback-filled scenic drive followed by a half-mile hike. Prepare for thin air and chilly temperatures. On the park's eastern ridge, Snake Creek Road trades elevation for solitude, a dirt road corridor that naturally filters out crowds while opening up wide valley views framed by pine, juniper, and fir. Just outside the park boundary, the Baker Archaeological Site, managed by the Bureau of Land Management, offers flat, open desert skies with minimal obstructions and easy roadside access, making it a practical, low-effort option for wide Milky Way compositions, especially if you want to forego the climb. So those are four amazing places that you can go to see the darkest sky available. And it says here there are 63 national parks, and there's 18 of them that have been certified international dark sky places. So if you want to look at find more of those, you can go to the Dark Sky International website and find out more. So the four places we highlighted were, again, Voyageurs National Park in Minnesota, Glacier National Park in Montana, Bryce Canyon National Park in Utah, and finally, Great Basin National Park in Nevada. Our last piece here is a little companion piece on the dark side. These expert-backed astrophotography tricks will help you capture crisp stars and dramatic night landscapes anywhere. Number one, pack the right light. A red light headlamp is essential. You're trying to keep your eyes adapted to the dark, and white light affects that, says astrophotographer Dan Stein. You'll need to navigate trails, but because any light source interferes with long exposure photos, switch it off before shooting. On smartphones, enable the screen's red filter in accessibility settings and cover the flashlight with red cellophane secured by a rubber band. So basically, get a red light headlamp if you're going to be hiking around where you're going to be taking these pictures. Give your arm a rest. Astrophotography requires long exposures to capture faint starlight, which means the camera must remain perfectly still. Even small hand movements introduce motion blur, Stein says. A sturdy tripod is essential. Stein also recommends a Bluetooth shutter so you're not risking a tremor by pressing the camera's screen or button. You can also use your Apple Watch to trigger your phone shot. So have a tripod and use a Bluetooth shutter. Three, dial in the exposure triangle. Low light confuses auto mode. Switch to manual. Set the white balance to daylight and open the aperture as wide as possible, around f3.5 on a DSLR standard 18 to 55 millimeter, to flood the sensor with light. Set the shutter speed to 20 seconds, shorter if stars start to trail or longer if it's too dark. Dial your ISO between 800 and 6400, depending on how bright the scene. Center the lens on a bright star, then use digital zoom to enlarge it. Rotate the focus back and forth until the star appears as sharp as possible. Now, I don't understand hardly any of that, but if you have real cameras, DSLR cameras, and you will know what to do there. So definitely put it on manual mode and try to dial it in the way this thing described, and that'll help. And here's a really good example, a good tip. Four, use apps while planning. Rely on planning tools to predict visibility. Apps like Planet Pro, and that's spelled P-L-A-N-I-T, Planet Pro, for only $5, simulate scenes in advance, showing exactly where the celestial objects will sit relative to your chosen foreground, while factoring in light pollution and elevation to avoid wasted trips. Astropheric, that's A-S-T-R-O-S-P-H-E-R-I-C, which is free, blends weather models to estimate cloud cover, humidity, and atmospheric transparency. So those are two apps that I am going to write down right now and make sure that I check out, because I love looking at the night sky, and I have never been able to figure out how to actually take pictures of it that come out even remotely good. But I got to tell you, someday I'd like to get to one of these dark sky places and just see the night sky like you can't see it any place that's near cities. So hopefully that was as entertaining to you as it was to me. Our next story is, believe it or not, from People Magazine, dated July 16th, again, my birthday. This one's about one of my favorite actors. There's certain movies when they come on TV, when I'm just flipping around, you know, and I happen upon them, I stop. And I will, if I don't have time to watch the whole thing, I'll hit record, you know, even though I've seen them dozens of times, probably. One of those, at the top of the list, one of the top five is probably The Martian with Matt Damon. One of my favorite movies of all time. And he is, I mean, if you think about it, he's on screen by himself probably 50 to 75% of that movie. It's almost like, I tell people, it's kind of like Castaway on Mars, you know? And he carries that movie and he's amazing in it. And it has all my favorite things, you know, space travel, basically. And humor. He's funny. He's a funny guy, but he's able to do action sequences and serious stuff. And he's just great. So here is a story from People Magazine. Matt Damon is not slowing down. Matt Damon isn't the belly aching type. Ask him about his hardest day on the grueling 6-month shoot for The Odyssey, an adaptation of Homer's ancient Greek poem about a hero's quest to return home from war to his wife, Anne Hathaway, and son, played by Tom Holland. And he's quick to point to the crew's collective pain. Voyaging between locations in Iceland, Morocco, Italy, Scotland, and Greece with IMAX cameras in tow felt more like an expedition than a movie, says Damon, age 55. In his third film with acclaimed director Christopher Nolan, following 2014's Interstellar and 2023's Oppenheimer, Damon carved himself down to 167 pounds of shredded muscle to play the plagued Odysseus and was alternately stuffed into a giant Trojan horse and lashed with fake rain by two jet engines, like 737 engines, blowing water on us, he says. The Wrath of Poseidon was also sometimes just an out-of-frame bucket. At the end, we were shooting some close-up raft stuff that was too dangerous to do on the open water, that involved Chris pouring water over my face while I was lying there. And I was like, this is perfect. We're ending this with waterboarding, he says, laughing. Back on dry land, the Brooklyn-based dad of four daughters with wife Luciana, 50, Alexia, 27, Isabella, 20, Gia, 17, and Stella, 15, ticks off his priorities in this era of his life. Passion Projects, his longtime nonprofit, water.org, and locking into the last few years he has kids still at home. Having two older kids who are out of the nest and knowing how fast these final years go, we're trying to be mindful of holding on to what we can, he says. Born in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and raised by his late father, Kent, a stockbroker, and mother, Nancy, a professor of early childhood education, the enduring star was bitten by the acting bug young alongside his childhood friend, Ben Affleck. We were in our teens coming down to New York on the train or on the bus to audition for things like the Mickey Mouse Club, Damon recalls. Then 1997's Good Will Hunting launched them both to stardom, winning them Oscars for screenwriting. Their moms were their dates. I remember now, it just said he's 55, and that was 30 years ago. So he was 25 years old when Good Will Hunting came out. Damon has since dominated the box office across decades, hopping from crime dramas and black comedies to blockbuster franchises while earning Oscar nominations for 2009's sports drama Invictus and 2015's sci-fi adventure The Martian. Today, his quest is simple. I think you get on the other side of 50, and at least for me, I really start feeling like time is the most precious commodity there is, he says. I just want to be intentional with what I do with it. Your transformation in The Odyssey is remarkable. Is there a cost to changing your body radically at this age? I think if I had done the opposite and put weight on, that would have been dangerous, and it's not something I'll do anymore. I was happy to do it earlier in my career, in my life, but this was more about getting really, really physically fit, which involves a whole lifestyle change. You have to be very intentional about everything you're putting in your body. I stopped eating gluten, among other things. What does your family think when you commit like this? When they came to visit in Favignana, Italy, I promised them I was going to have pasta with them. The night came, we went out to a little restaurant, and we all ordered pasta. And right after I ordered it, I called the waiter back, and I was like, I'll just please have a steak instead. And the kids were like, but you promise. So I took a bite of each of theirs, but at that point I was just in it. It was going to be 4 or 5 months of shooting, and I was like, it's all or nothing at this point. Shooting inside the Trojan horse sounds claustrophobic. Do you have any phobias left? I worked through a lot of them on this one, definitely. Claustrophobia was one, but I hope I'm on the other side of that one now. We were filming The Fall of Troy, I think it was a Friday, and we were shooting the horse on Tuesday, and I said, Chris, how are you going to do the horse? And he goes, yeah, I don't know. That's the thing I love about him. It's basically like an independent film. The way we were going to shoot the horse was we were all going to get in the horse and figure it out. Now that the kids are older, do they give you pointed notes on your work? I have one daughter who's really not reverential at all about my movies and loves to give me shit. She saw The Odyssey, and at the end, she actually turned to me and she said, Dad, I'm proud of you. He laughs. She never said anything like that because we joke around a lot. At that point, I was kind of like, I'm good. It was all worth it. You have 2 daughters at home for a few more years. How are you embracing or facing that? I feel like we're facing it and embracing the fact that it's happening. We've been talking a lot about presence and about really trying to be in the moment because you can't slow time down. Also, we have all these family challenges to be off our phones and things like that. You've been married to Luciana for more than 20 years. What's kept your relationship strong? There's a lot of love and respect underneath the relationship and a lot of trust. And so it's built on a very sturdy foundation. We continue to grow and evolve as people. And so that foundation is really everything. It's the greatest thing in my life. And there's a picture of her, him and her. She's beautiful, obviously Italian. And he has 4 gorgeous daughters, various ages. And he's a very, very, very proud father. After being part of each other's lives for so long, you and Ben Affleck are now facing the empty nest years with college tours and adult kids. Do you talk about it? Oh, we talk about it all the time. It doesn't take much to get us emotional at this point. We're at very similar stages with our kids. It's definitely a new phase of life. It was one of the reasons we started the production company, getting into our 50s and going, this is the time to do this. We're young enough to have the energy to do it and old enough to appreciate why we should do it, to make really good movies with our friends and with people we want to work with. Now you're also working with Luciana, who is producing alongside you at Artist Equity. What is it like to mix your professional life and your home life? Well, that's not really a change at all, because she's been a part of that for me since I've known her. She reads everything I'm doing, and she looks at cuts of movies. I've relied on her notes for 23 years. While I was doing The Odyssey, she was producing the movie that Ben was directing called Animals, and so they have their own work life and creative professional relationship. He came out of that experience and said he wouldn't direct the movie if she wasn't producing it. At home, do the Damons have any family traditions? We have family dinner every night, and that's non-negotiable. It's always been that way. But in fact, we had a conversation about it. Because we have the company in Los Angeles, sometimes there are calls and there's work going on during dinner in New York. Lucy and I are, oh, I've just got to return this text, or this person needs an answer to this. And one of my daughters said, well, at family dinner last night, we didn't talk. We realized, oh my gosh, you're right. You can get lost in that routine and not appreciate why you established it in the first place. So that's the kind of family mindfulness we're all working on. Something to shoot for. What have you taken away from living in a house of women? I was raised with just a brother, and so it was a very different energy, a real different way to grow up. I feel like it was such a blessing in my 30s to suddenly have this whole new world open up to me. It's been just such a gift, how sophisticated women are and how fast. He laughs. I used to joke that by the time my daughter was 2, she had me totally wrapped around her finger. How do you feel about your career now versus when you started out? I remember at age 25, I got the part in The Rainmaker. Francis Ford Coppola gave me that job, and I'll never forget that. It's just been an amazing journey. Some of the movies didn't work, but ideally in another 10 years, I'd like to just keep doing things that I can feel really proud of. Odysseus rails against the gods, believing he can determine his own fate. What's your take on that at this stage of your life? I just try to think about what I can control and what I can't. And instead of railing against the gods about things I can't control, being fastidious and intentional about what I can and accepting what I can't. You live long enough and things happen and tragedy comes and visits you no matter who you are, and you just have to accept what happens. I think starting out as an actor, you have to feel that way a little bit because the odds are so long against you. You need to have that kind of defy the gods mentality to go into this life, because it's a bit of the circus life, and it's not a normal way to go. But at this stage in my life, I feel a lot more at peace, and I'm happy for other people's success. I don't feel myself in competition with other people, whereas when you're young and other people get jobs, you're like, I could have done that. Now I'm just really happy for people who are doing a good job. And finally, the last question, what does a perfect day off look like for you? It can be as simple as yesterday. I was at home with my kids, I took one of them to the orthodontist, and it was a great day off. It's nice to just sometimes run some errands with the people you love. Here's a quick little blurb about the Boston brothers, Ben and Matt. Still close friends, Damon and Ben Affleck, winning the Best Original Screenplay Oscar for Good Will Hunting, launched a production company, Artist Equity, in 2022. Ben and I bolstered each other when we were young, says Damon. We were the only people who believed in each other, who said, yeah, you're going to make it. And our dreams came true, and the greatest disservice we could do for our younger selves would be to not work together. So they will continue to work together, probably until the day they die. And so the movie, again, is called The Odyssey. It's by Christopher Nolan, who is one of the greatest directors of our time, and he doesn't make anything small. His movies are all huge in one way or the other. And we haven't seen it yet. It's come out recently. And if you're going to see it, go see it in IMAX. You got to see it in IMAX. I went to see the Ryan Gosling movie Hail Mary a few months ago in IMAX, and I would not have seen it any other way. It's a long one. I mean, The Odyssey is almost 3 hours long, so you got to be ready for that. But it's amazing. It's got, I can't tell you how many great actors, including Academy Award winning and nominated actors in it. It's a huge, huge cast by everybody you could ever imagine. And it's just one of those movies I have to see, and I'm going to have to see it in the IMAX. My wife, maybe not. It's not her cup of tea, but especially the fact that it's almost 3 hours long. But anyway, don't miss The Odyssey. Don't miss Matt Damon in one of the all-time movies that he will ever make in his lifetime. Of course, I say that, and then next year he'll be in something else that's even better. But this is, The Odyssey is definitely a movie you do not want to miss, and definitely see it at the movie theater. It will be so much more fun than if you watched it at home on TV. That is all the time we have, guys. So please come back next Friday, and I'll bring you some more stories that I think that men will enjoy. And I hope you have a great weekend, and take care.